Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be in Toronto again. It seems I was only here yesterday, but I think it was a few weeks ago. And since that time, the war has escalated in Afghanistan, as we predicted it would the last time we gathered. And essentially, the situation at the present time in Afghanistan is pretty clear. That after weeks and weeks of pretty indiscriminate bombing, which has destroyed large parts of what was already wrecked cities, there have been heavy casualties of civilians in southern Afghanistan, in Kabul, in Kandahar, and in certain mountain villages. I don't know whether the media in North America has been showing images of this, but certainly these images have been seen on European television, largely due to Al Jazeera, the television network based in Qatar, which has been broadcasting these images. I mean, as you probably know, the Red Cross depot in Afghanistan was hit not once but twice by U.S. bombs. And when the Pentagon was asked, hitting it once is bad enough, why did you hit it twice? They said, we forgot to take it off the target list after the first hit. In other words, the level of cynicism in relation to that bombing is quite incredible. And what really strikes me is so completely hypocritical, and the double standards in operation, is that the same people who are extremely upset by the death of thousands of people in New York City, and understandably so, they have every right to be upset. I'm upset. But that the people who are upset by this are unmoved by the sight of innocent civilian deaths in Afghanistan. That's what I can't understand. And that's what... And this is the form, the sort of double standards which creates recruits from despairing populations all over the world. People think that they are being ignored. People think that a Western life is worth more than a life anywhere else in the world. And this sort of bombing campaign and civilian deaths which are taking place in Afghanistan tends to prove that point. Now, what are we witnessing in Afghanistan today? The Northern Alliance, which the previous speaker has pointed out, is essentially a bunch of corrupt gangster politicians with their own armies who now control the bulk of the heroin trade are being greeted as liberators. I mean, I was quite staggered to read in the New York Times a few days ago an incredibly friendly profile of General Dostum. As if somehow this guy was a, you know, nice liberal Democrat who'd turned up from nowhere and was going to take Mazar-e-Sharif. I mean, what could be further than the truth? And this is what always happens when the West wages a war, that the level of disinformation and propaganda reaches unheard-of levels, and a population largely kept ignorant because there's been no real reporting of the international situation prior to this war tends to be trusting and believe everything that is handed out to it. And it's the combination of these two things, the general dumbing down of the media, the general underplaying what is going on in the rest of the world, coupled with hysterical propaganda when a war is being fought, the combination of these two is pretty devastating for political consciousness. And the effect of this is actually to weaken democracy and to weaken accountability in all the Western countries where this happens. And this doesn't just apply to North America, it applies just as much to large chunks of Western Europe. Very, very similar processes taking place. So now we have a situation where, because of the heavy bombing, the Northern Alliance is poised to take Kabul with some ground troops supplied by the United States and Britain. Now, if they take Kabul, and they are on the outskirts of it even as we speak, this is going to create massive problems with Pakistan, which has been fighting the Northern Alliance for the last 10 years. This is going to create, over the next year or two, mayhem inside Pakistan itself. Because a lot of the Taliban, incapable now of fighting without Pakistani support in the Pakistan army, will shave their beards and come back into Pakistan. In fact, if you get the reports from Mazar-e-Sharif over the last few days, all the indications are that that's exactly what is happening. I mean, I have no illusions that the Taliban were going to be a grand resistance to this. They're not. Some will go into the mountain villages and probably fight on. Most will surrender. I think Kabul, Kandahar, all these big cities will fall. We knew that. How can they resist this incredible a military power which is being used against them? It's virtually impossible. And I'm not one of those who has ever believed in the invincibility of certain nations. It all depends on a whole variety of contingent factors. Level of local support, level of popular support, level of support coming from the outside. The Russians were defeated because the United States determined that they should be defeated. Massive amount of weaponry and aid was given to Osama bin Laden and to other groups of the Mujahideen to defeat them. The Pakistani army was used as a conduit. But if you don't have that support from the outside, if the Pakistani army is completely cut off, if the border is sealed, if the supply lines no longer exist and you bomb them inside out, of course they'll crumble. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But what is going to be created in Afghanistan now? The Northern Alliance, in my opinion, is not a credible alternative government. So are they going to import the king from outside? I mean, he's very stupid if he leaves his comfortable Roman villa and goes to Kabul, which has no Roman villas left now. But he might. People, you know, even when they're very old, can still be very vain. So he might decide that this is his last throw and go up. But let's suppose they even take the king back. Then what? What about all the refugees all over the world? Afghan refugees who've left because of the civil wars of the last 30 years. Are they going to come back just like that? All the middle-class professionals who left, the doctors, the teachers, large numbers of trained professional women who left that country over the last 25 years, are they just going to come back? You can't recreate this just like that. There has to be an organic process of rebuilding a country. And that organic process has to take place from within the country itself. That's the big difference with what's going on in Iran today. What's happening in Iran is a new generation which has been born and experienced and lived under that regime is saying, enough, no more. We don't like living in these conditions. And they themselves have created the new conditions. And the bulk of the people who live in Iran today, an overwhelming majority of the population, is under 28, 27 years of age. These are young people who have grown up under this regime. And that is the best experience. That is the best way people learn, through their own experiences, not through being bombed by the Western powers. That never teaches people anything. It seems like a shortcut, you know, but it never works. And that's why when I read articles now appearing in some of the European papers from some historians writing, saying, well, so what if we're imperialists? What's so bad about that? We're superior. We'll take a better system of government there. Really? Forgotten the whole history of the 19th century? Forgotten what imperialism did to large parts of the world? forgotten the 12 million Congolese killed by King Leopold in the Congo at the beginning of the 20th century? That's the figure, 12 million black people in the Congo wiped out by King Leopold. Forgotten the large mass famines deliberately created by British imperialism in India? Forgotten the number of people killed in numerous massacres? I mean, do you know that there's a very interesting statistic that all the time the British Empire existed, every single day of its existence, somewhere or the other in that empire, there was resistance. Every single day, there was resistance in some corner or the other. So to create a population which has become completely amnesiac, have forgotten the past, have forgotten what imperialism was, what it did in the 19th and 20th centuries, and imagine that somehow a cleaned up, modified, new version of imperialism is going to work, is living in cloud cuckoo land. It isn't going to work. It didn't work before, and it's not going to work now. What it does, this sort of attitude, is essentially create and encourage despair and religious fundamentalisms of various sorts. It actually encourages it. Now, I remember going to Kabul. I just want to tell you this, because people may not remember and may not know. I remember going to Kabul in the late 60s and the early 70s. It was a totally modern city. You could walk on the streets and the avenues of Kabul, young men and young women together, women on their own, men on their own, cafe discussions, intellectual discussions, normal everyday life taking place. You can go to many other cities of the world, in the Islamic world, which were like that. And systematically, in all these countries, all the openings that existed were wiped out. As the previous speaker said, first in Iran, in 1951, a democratically elected government of Mossadegh defeated. Then in 1956, a fear of Nasser and radical nationalism, Britain, France, and Israel invade Egypt to try and stop the nationalization of the Suez Canal. Failed. Then in 1967, the first, what I call the first oil war, otherwise known as the Six-Day War, the first oil war is fought to defeat radical nationalism in the Middle East. Partially successful. Systematically, everywhere you look, secular regimes in the Islamic world were destabilized by the United States, and ultimately many of the leaders in these countries were destroyed. In Pakistan, they encouraged a military coup in 1977, which led to the arrest of the elected Prime Minister Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, who was then executed by a military dictator, who basically then patronized and created a whole number of religious extremist organizations in Pakistan. In the last three general elections, the religious parties have got less than 5% of the vote in Pakistan. So what is going on then? Why blame the people of these countries for the problems which have been created by US foreign policy as practiced over the last 50 years? And if one believed that what they were doing was to say sorry, was to say forgive us, we made a big mess and we're clearing it up, I wouldn't agree with the way they're doing it, but I'd understand. But they're not clearing it up, they're making an even bigger mess today by going in the way in which they're going in to Afghanistan and these places. These problems are not going to be solved by bombing. And now the United States is saying, or sections within the United States administration are saying, that this is only the beginning. that after we finished up in Afghanistan, we're going to go into the Middle East. We're going to clear out Saddam Hussein in Iraq. We may even attack Syria. And this is now opening up a division between the United States and the European Union, because neither the French nor the Germans want this war to be extended into the Middle East for obvious reasons. They're really worried that a new war in the Middle East could explode Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and Egypt. The oil supplies could be restricted, and the Western economies, already in the grip of a mild recession, could get a recession which is infinitely worse. It's a very dangerous situation, both militarily and economically in that sense. So they don't want this war to spread. And then the central problem of the Middle East still remains unsolved, which all those of us who oppose this war and who oppose the terrorist attacks on New York have said, unless you think of a political solution, this problem is not going to finish. And at the heart of this political solution is the Palestinian question in the Middle East. It is not going to finish unless the Palestinians get an independent and viable state. And if you follow the pattern of what's taking place in Palestine, over the last 25 years, systematically, the secular Palestinian leaderships have been weakened, terrorized, killed, beaten, and so what remains of them now is an extremely weak and enfeebled Al-Fatah leadership led by Yasser Arafat, pretty discredited. And if they can't even do a deal with Yasser Arafat, who's bent over backwards to deal with them, then what they'll be left with are the people who initially they created to try and destabilize Arafat, but who, like everywhere else in the world, got completely out of control, the people of Hamas. Then they'll have to deal with them. Best of luck to them. But this is a systematic pattern now in the policy of the West. But unless Palestine comes into being, this problem is not going to be solved. Then you look at the geopolitical impact of this war within South Asia, where you have two countries with nuclear weapons, India and Pakistan, and a divided province contested by both these countries, Kashmir, where there's been a low-intensity war going on now for several years. The casualty rate in Kashmir is higher than it is in Palestine. More Kashmiris are killed every month. The world doesn't notice, but people in that part of the world do notice, and they know. And so tensions within that region are quite high. And what the United States bombing of Afghanistan does is set up a precedent. We can do it. If they can do it, regional big powers will say, we can do it as well. We can declare X or Y or Z to be a terrorist and go and start bombing them. So it's an extremely dangerous situation in all these countries. And then the last point is the growing attack, which all our speakers have mentioned, the growing attack on civil liberties, which we notice all over the Western world. I tell you something. If I was Osama bin Laden, reading newspaper reports or watching television broadcasts saying how the West is restricting civil liberties, I'd be laughing, because this is a victory he couldn't have dreamed of. That these actions would create such fear and panic in Western governments that they would immediately start restricting civil liberties, ethnically profiling people, and introducing laws, which the British Home Secretary said 2 days ago, which means they can arrest anyone on the suspicion of being a terrorist and hold him or her indefinitely. And you have no right even to legal to lawyers unless and until their interrogation is complete. The FBI, as we know, wants to torture suspects to make them talk. And a Newsweek columnist wrote recently, maybe it's necessary to agree to this to jumpstart the process. How do you jumpstart it? With electrodes? I mean, they know how to do it because they've been doing it in Latin America for many years, the CIA. So it's not a secret, but torture is illegal at the present time. But just think about it. Serious American journalists saying that perhaps we should use torture to jumpstart the process of getting confessions from people who won't talk. And this is part of a war to save freedom, to save democracy. That's how far this business has gone. And against this, therefore, the anti-war movement needs to be built, and it needs to be built as a long-term movement. Because we need to organize. We have a situation now in all the major Western countries where there is hardly any opposition in parliament at all. All the major political parties are in broad agreement with official policies. In the face of this, and in the face of a concerted media assault, a propaganda assault, we have to find our own ways of communicating. We have to find our own ways of opposing. Because one reason they are putting on the pressure is to try and stop opposition. One reason for these anti-terrorist laws is not so much that they think it's going to stop the problems in the Middle East, it's also to frighten off the new generation of anti-globalization protesters and tell them, don't go out and demonstrate. So it's directed against everyone. And we've got to resist. I was quite taken aback. I was in Munich a few weeks ago speaking at a seminar organized by the Goethe Institute on Islam and civil society, discussing precisely questions of religion and state and whether they should be the same or not. You know, quite a detailed two-day conference. And on my way out of Munich, I was stopped. And the reason I was stopped is not that they knew who I was, it's because they didn't know who I was. They just saw the color of my skin, they saw my passport and the name, and they stopped me. And they searched, and of course they found nothing. Then they began to look at my papers and my notebooks. At this point I said, these are in English. But I can help you out because an article of mine is published in your largest newspaper today. If you want my views, you can read them in German. At that point, they grabbed the German paper and rushed off. A German publisher had given me a book, which he'd published, and said, here you are, Tariq, you'll find this interesting when you get back to London. It's a new little book by Karl Marx we've published. So I put it in my briefcase without even looking. When they finally found this book, they looked at the book, then they looked at me. And I then suddenly noticed that it was an essay by Karl Marx on suicide. Well, this to them meant suicide, Muslim name, Karl Marx. Where is this all going to end, they must have thought. And I could see from the look on their faces that they thought they had actually captured someone. So they rushed with this book by Marx to get armed policemen. So the armed policeman came to me and said, will you come with us? So I said, yeah. So we walked up to the police station at Munich Airport. And on the way up, this armed policeman said, you know, you shouldn't travel, after September the 11th, you shouldn't travel with books like this. And I said, you know something, after September the 11th, do you think Germany should publish books like this? And he looked at me and I said, well, you know, they're published in Germany. He said, yes, I know. So I said, why don't you make a bonfire of them and burn them on the streets? He didn't get the point. Then we arrived up at the police station. And they said, we're not going to let you board this flight, so forget about that. We're going to question you because of these books and papers. So at that point, I did lose my temper, I have to admit, having remained very calm till then, and said I insisted on making a phone call. And they said, who do you want to ring? And I said, I want to ring the mayor of Munich. So a man called Christian Ude, social democratic mayor, quite radical. I said he interviewed me at a big bookshop where I was signing copies of my novels and questioned me about the war. So here's his phone number. Ring him up and tell him I want to speak to him so I can tell him about what's going on. And then, of course, within 2 seconds, all my things had been returned and they accompanied me back to the plane. Now, the interesting thing is this. I wrote this up. And it went on, it was published in the German papers and the British paper, and it went online. And within the first 3 days of publication, I was deluged with emails from all over the world. People recounting crazy instances of what was happening to them. One guy with a Muslim name wrote to me. He said, I was traveling from Toronto to Sydney. I'd been in Canada on business. I was going back home to Sydney. And in my briefcase, because of the work I do, I had a copy of Jane's Defense Weekly. This is the sort of house journal of the arms industry. And The Economist and 2 or 3 other publications like that, because that's my job. He said, when I arrived at Sydney, they saw my face and my name and passport and just searched me. Then they found these books. They then took me to the police station at Sydney Airport, fingerprinted me, asked me all sorts of questions. Finally, after 2 hours, they let me go. But when I arrived back at work the following Monday, within 2 weeks, I was handed my notice. Now, that's just one episode I'm telling you. There were dozens and dozens and dozens of episodes from all over the Western world about what's going on. So this challenge to our civil liberties is a challenge to everyone. It's not just a challenge to those who are affected. And that is one reason, one important reason amongst others, to go out, to demonstrate, to build our strength, to be together, to show solidarity with each other, and to show the governments of the West that we are not going to be bullied, we are going to oppose their wars, this one or any other one, we're going to fight for democratic rights and accountability all over the world, including the Western world. We don't believe that the war on terrorism is going to stop terrorism the way it's being conducted. It's going to increase it. We believe that the only way out is long-term political solutions on a global level. We believe that what they have done now to the world is created not so much a clash of civilizations, but a clash of fundamentalisms. Neoliberal economics has become a fundamentalism for the Western countries. And it creates responses of this kind elsewhere. And we have to tell them loudly and clearly that we will not sit down and be cowed down by the new laws which they are proposing, but that we will fight back with all the power we have. Thank you.
I'm waiting for them.